Well, good evening. We still have decent weather in San Francisco. The rains haven't begun again. And so it looks like we have a great turnout. Thank you for coming tonight to the World Affairs Council. And my name is Marcos Kounoulakis. I'm a trustee here. And I also am the publisher and president of the Washington Monthly. Tonight, we're pleased to have with us a panel of guests. I'll start to my immediate left here. It's Rafiq Dosani, Senior Research Scholar and Director of the South Asia Initiative at Stanford University's Shorenstein Asia-Pacific Research Center. Noel Jock, who is Senior Fellow at the Center for Global Security Research at the Lawrence Livermore National Labs. And Daniel Snyder at the far end, Associate Director for Research at Stanford's Shorenstein Asia-Pacific Research Center. I've already introduced myself. And want to tell you a bit about the World Affairs Council. I'm sure many of you are familiar with it, but it always invites you to join us online by going to the website, itsyourworld.org. When you can't attend a program, you can go to the council website. You can find podcasts and streaming online. And, of course, we have, you may have noticed these microphones attached to a tape machine to my right, and that is KQED FM 88.5, and the broadcast of It's Your World, which will include this program, is weekly, every Monday evening at 8, and tonight's recording engineer is David Ogilvie. And finally, a bit more housekeeping here for those of you who want to attend some of our other programs at the World Affairs Council on Wednesday, February 11th. We're going to have Laurel Fletcher, director of UC Berkeley's International Human Rights Law Clinic, and Eric Stover, who's director of UC Berkeley's Human Rights Center, in conversation with Elizabeth Farnsworth, and they're going to discuss the future of the Guantanamo Bay detention camps. And the council is also delighted to announce its 63rd annual conference. Many of you are probably familiar with it as ASILMAR. In the past, it has been changed, and we are now having the annual conference in San Francisco. As usual, we bring together political leaders, policymakers, public intellectuals, and diplomats to explore the most crucial global issues facing this year, the Obama administration. The conference will be held on April 2nd and 3rd, and it's just down the street at the Westin St. Francis on Union Square. Finally, and I think most of you already have done this, you'll find those blue question cards on your chair. Feel free to fill them out at any point during this evening's panel and hold them up, and someone will come by and pick them up. And then what we'll do is I'll collect them, look through, and pose your questions to our panel. And I'll try to put them into categories so that we can ask many questions at once. The final thing, and this holds true in every program, please turn off your cell phones and any pagers. Do people still carry pagers? No. Okay. Whatever it is that you have that buzzes or rings, please turn it off.
There's a pager.
So now, the panel. It's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speakers, Rafiq Dosani. I'll introduce them one at a time, and then they can introduce their topic. They'll speak for a short period, and we've divided up the areas about which we'll speak, and then we'll have the panel talk in general about these issues of the region. But Rafiq Dosani is a senior research scholar at Stanford University Shorenstein APARC and is responsible for developing and directing the South Asia Initiative. His research interests include South Asian security and financial, technological, and energy sector reform in India. His most recent books are India Arriving and Prospects for Peace in South Asia. Please join me in welcoming Rafiq Dosani.
Thank you, Marcos. It's a pleasure to be here, and I intend to focus my remarks on what happened in India during the terrorist attacks at the end of November. Of course, this had been just one of the latest in a string of such attacks during that period in India. It happened in other cities as well. This wasn't necessarily the most destructive. Actually, the most destructive in terms of lives lost was a couple of years earlier, when about 275 people were killed in train blasts in 2006 in Mumbai. But in this one, 180 people were killed. But there were some differences in terms of the timing, the targets, the government's response, and civil society's response that I'd like to cover. So first is that, it's very hard to stop such things in India. The reality is it's fairly porous. The borders are porous. Once you enter society, you really can't make out who's who, whether they're Indians, Pakistanis, Bangladeshis, Sri Lankans, Nepalese, Bhutanese. India is a country that has all these sort of racial, sort of sub-racial types represented, or so whatever one might want to call them, in plenty. You know, for example, I mean, just to give you an index of the diversity of India, the main radio station, All India Radio, broadcasts every day in 350 languages. So that's India. So in terms of actually trying to do good police work and trying to recognize who the terrorists are and how it happens is a task, a difficult one. It's not helped by a couple of things. One is the endemic problem of corruption in India, where police, whether it's policemen, other law enforcement, regulators, other compliance people, have traditionally looked the other way. And therefore, one can't really expect them to look the right way just because this event is happening. You know, for so many decades, they have sort of benefited politicians and others who break the law, particularly the rich, by looking the other way. An example is in India has a 500-meter building rule that is from the ocean point where a beach begins. You can't construct within 500 meters of the tide line, however it's defined. Now, if you go down any coastline in India, Bombay's one is particularly noticeable. What you see is a complete, disobeying of those rules. The rich particularly have built right up to even 50 meters of the coastline. So, corruption is endemic. So it makes it that much more difficult to solve the problem. And second is, it's such a diverse society. The other aspect which makes it very difficult, and one should recognize that such an event cannot have happened without local support. It's inconceivable that a group of terrorists, whether based in Pakistan, which Pakistan, of course, hotly disputes, or based somewhere else, God knows where, but it's reasonable, I think, to think they're based in Pakistan. But wherever they were based, it's impossible for them to have engineered such a thing without significant local support. Because the way the attacks were carried out, very detailed in different locations, they knew exactly what they were doing and where. It wasn't just driving a plane into a high building. So it was very, very different. It required local knowledge, months of scoping out. And there is evidence actually that the terrorists were registered as students in different Indian universities, that they spent a considerable amount of time scoping out the area. And this could not have been done without the local involvement at various levels, both official level. The police would have had to have been paid off and not over several months have flagged this. But also the local Muslim population, which is a problem for the government, because how do they then implicate this population without saying that there are traitors within? But the reality is that the disenfranchisement of the local Muslim population has been increasing with time, to the extent that large parts of urban India have Muslim ghettos. And that's a reality that now is starting to have this sort of negative impact. Now, in terms of timing and where the terrorists targeted their attacks, in May of 2009, India must hold national elections. So according to the parliamentary system, the government can call elections any time before that, but it's a weak government, a minority government, which the Congress Party, which rules in coalition with others. So this government has performed well. India, as you all know, has been doing reasonably well, with 9% rates of growth for the last few years. The challenge has been, as the previous government found, is that that's not necessarily good enough to get re-elected. The reason it's not good enough is the way it happened. It's not that everybody's growing at 9%. It's still the case that most of rural India is not growing at 9%. If one tries to break it down, what one sees is that about 70% of India is growing as it has always grown. That's all of rural India, which is about, you know, 60% of the population. Most low-end services, some manufacturing. So 70% of India is growing at the old rate of 5-5.5%. And then you have the rest of India, which you see in Bombay and Delhi, you know, outsourcing, IT services, other professional services, some manufacturing, growing at 15-20% a year. So that's the government's challenge, that they need the votes from that 60-70% if they ever have to have any hope of being re-elected. And so the only plank, really, that they can stand on in the upcoming elections to that 70%, which continues to be out of the system in some ways, is stability. So this is the big challenge for the Congress party, which rules the government, is that an attack like this threatens its stability. And any response it makes, which is very muscular, saying we'll pursue the terrorists, bomb their camps, and we'll hear from other speakers on how difficult that is. But any such response upsets the population. You're not going to have any upsurge of national fervor which will offset the concern that for 70% of the population, things have not gone well. And particularly for the Muslim population and other minorities, that the plank of stability is severely disturbed. So this is the problem, and which is partly explains why the government of India's reaction has been somewhat muted. They've talked the talk, and certainly the US has done its fair bit to try and calm things down, but there's not really much that they can do, and this creates a real challenge for the government. It also creates a challenge for those who would want a muscular reaction. That's particularly to the elite civil society, which are suffering anyway. There's a downturn going on. Events like these hurt the image of India, hurts business, it hurts many people's moral sense of what ought to be done. And so from the elite side, there's plenty of pressure on the government, the media, which is, of course, very vibrant in India. You may not know this, but, compared with the U.S., where we have 2,000 newspapers, India has 45,000 newspapers. So, it's a very vibrant, very alert, very active, very free media. And they're on the government's case, saying this is not acceptable. So the government is really caught in a difficult situation right now. And it doesn't quite know what to do. So now, just wrapping up and looking ahead, how does this affect India's external posture? Relations with Pakistan may have improved a little bit over the last year, but it's pretty much where it was over the last 45, 50 years. Very, very bad. It's been floundering along at bottom for so long that you can't really say that in any sense there's been any substantive improvement over the last several decades. Being that close to bottom, really there's not much to give on the downside, but it certainly removes, at least in the near term, the possibility of an upswing in relationships. However much the Pakistani government may claim that they're not responsible for the attacks and that these were planned offshore or by non-state actors, all of these, in a sense, bolster the Indian view that the Pakistani government does not have legitimacy over its population to direct foreign policy or to direct policy generally, which then creates a problem for any improvement in relations. So with that, let me wrap up my remarks. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Professor Dasani. And that's a great contextualization of India in these post-Mumbai attack period. And so let's move on to Pakistan, the neighbor, and for that we'll turn to Neil Jock, who is a senior fellow at the Center for Global Security Research at the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, and he's an adjunct professor of political science at the University of California at Berkeley. He served from 2004 to 2005 as director for counterproliferation strategy at the National Security Council. Dr. Jock was primarily responsible for India and Pakistan proliferation issues, and with that we'll look to you to give us some Pakistani context.
Thank you very much, Marcos, and thank you all for coming here on this beautiful night and listening to us instead of enjoying the lovely weather here. Let me say a few words about Pakistan, and I'll touch on three areas in a somewhat cursory fashion and invite comments from you as much as anything. The first is to take a look at why Pakistan appears to continue to support terrorism, and to understand that better, I'll say just a couple of words about its focus on Kashmir as well as Afghanistan. The second thing I'll take a look at is how Pakistan is likely to respond and how it has responded to the Mumbai attacks. Then the third area will briefly to ask whether or not war is a likely consequence of this or in the near future if there are future such terrorist attacks. Well, why does Pakistan appear to support terrorism? And of course, in Pakistan, they use the word militancy, not terrorism. But in any case, it rests on their concerns about Kashmir and Afghanistan. Their concern with Kashmir goes back to the formation of the state. From Pakistan's perspective, the resolution of Kashmir has never occurred. And from their view, Kashmir ought to be part of Pakistan, and they feel as though that issue is not being given adequate respect. They fought a couple of wars in 1948, 1965 over Kashmir. They were focused very heavily on that, but realized in 1971 when their own inattention to internal problems created the civil war that produced Bangladesh, that they should pay more attention to internal integration than they had. That said, in early 1980s over in India, the Prime Minister of India, Indira Gandhi, was assassinated, leaving leadership of the country to her son, Rajiv Gandhi. As a newcomer, in a sense, to politics, he tried to assert his control from the center and to position himself for electoral success, and did so in a number of ways. But one way he did it was to manipulate electoral politics within Kashmir. The consequence of this, or one of the consequences, was to contribute to a great sense of disenfranchisement within Kashmir, within the young Muslims. What resulted was, in 1990, a breakdown of order and the beginning of what the Pakistanis continue to see as indigenous militancy within Kashmir to try and create a separate kind of state, or to separate and join Pakistan. India continues to see Kashmir issues resolved through the democratic process. But throughout the 90s, Pakistan supported militancy within Kashmir in order to exacerbate the problems for India within Kashmir and to keep Kashmir as a boiling issue. Now, in part, what they did was to support the formation of terrorist organizations that they would like to have focused entirely on Kashmir. And the problem we now see is that these organizations, Lashkar-e-Taiba, Harkat-ul-Mujahideen, Jaish-e-Mohammed, and so on, have now developed their own agenda. And Pakistan is whipsawed by its prior support and creation of some of these organizations, and them now following an agenda that is not consistent with Pakistan's own preferences. With respect to Afghanistan, Pakistan sees Afghanistan as a potential backdoor to itself and a dangerous flashpoint. Pakistan in 1979, when the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan, saw the possibility for encirclement by India. Well, why would India be connected? In 71 war, in 1970, India had signed a cooperation agreement with the Soviet Union. So from Pakistan's point of view, where the Soviets were involved, the Indians were not far behind. And as a consequence, when the Soviet Union had invaded Afghanistan, Pakistan was concerned that India, in collaboration with the Soviets, would be able to make mischief in Pakistan's along Pakistan's border. When the Soviet Union was then kicked out of Afghanistan through the work of the Mujahideen and funded by the Americans and the Pakistanis, it was possible for Pakistan to try and reassert control over Afghanistan and prevent India from getting a toehold. As a consequence, Pakistan supported the Taliban in the subsequent civil war that took place within Afghanistan. The Taliban was ultimately successful. That policy worked fine until September 11th, 2001, when the Al-Qaeda forces within Afghanistan, supported by the Taliban, turned their attention to the U.S. and attacked the U.S. The U.S. was then responded to that attack by saying to the Taliban, either give us Al-Qaeda, Osama bin Laden, or we will come and get them. And of course, we know the history. The U.S. then engaged in war against the Taliban, ran the Taliban out of Kabul, and they took up residency basically back in Pakistan from whence they had begun. Now, from Pakistan's point of view, they need the U.S. assistance to feel confident that they can confront Pakistan, can confront India. They also want to make sure that when the U.S. leaves, if it does, that the Taliban would then have some sort of position back in Kabul. So they have a very ambivalent attitude about joining with the U.S. in trying to get rid of the Taliban, because in their view, in the long term, they need them to help against India. So these two factors contribute to Pakistan's ambivalent view of the issue of militancy. How will Pakistan respond then to Indian accusations with respect to Mumbai? From Pakistan's point of view, they still are nothing more than accusations. At the government level, they have not yet released their response to the brief that India has presented with respect to the perpetrators. India has claimed that the perpetrators came from Lashkar-e-Taiba, based in Pakistan, and that the terrorists in Mumbai were directed by Lashkar-e-Taiba operatives. The Pakistan government has not responded to the evidence presented by India to the government as yet. One official was quoted sort of leaning too far forward on the issue, that they do not believe that it was, they are going to take an official position that it was not planned in Pakistan, but we have to see. At the popular level, the Pakistanis will not be supportive of a conclusion that they had anything to do with what was going on. They tend to make the argument that India is responsible for its own internal terrorism. Indeed, one American scholar made the comment shortly after this attack that this was not India's 9/11, but rather it was India's Oklahoma City, implying that this was an internal problem, internal terrorism that India was trying to blame on Pakistan. And I think at a popular level, this theme will continue to animate Pakistani thinking. At the military level, there are calls for disbanding the ISI, the Inner Services Intelligence Directorate. Well, from the military perspective, they need the ISI to carry out the normal intelligence activities that a government requires in order to defend itself. And so they will resist the arguments that this is somehow this terrorist attack is somehow caused by the ISI operating as an independent maverick, and they'll reject the idea that militant groups, as they call them, are in any way controlled by the Pakistan military. And as a rule, they will also universally deny that this was perpetrated with any government intervention. Let me briefly talk about whether war is likely, and then turn things over to Dan. Is war likely now as a consequence of this act? Well, from India's point of view, they are extremely frustrated by the continuance of what they see as Pakistan-supported terrorism launched against their country. And Rafiq pointed out that this was not the largest attack, the most deadly attack. That came with the Mumbai train attacks a few years ago. From India's perspective, they're getting extremely frustrated that Pakistan can get away with this. What they have done is developed a new military strategy that they hope will be able to address this problem. It's called the Cold Start Doctrine, and it emerged out of their frustrations in 1999 with a conflict that India and Pakistan had over Kargil. But what India wants to do is to be able to develop a capability for responding to these terrorist attacks, to deny Pakistan the ability to use terrorism to undercut the Indian state, but at the same time engage in conflict and not have it get so severe that will escalate to the nuclear level, because they both have a sharp understanding of their capabilities since they tested nuclear weapons in 1998. Well, the problem with the Cold Start Doctrine is multiple. Not everybody in India thinks it's a good idea. The idea Pakistan that India has developed is to have small unit, 8 to 10 battalions strength units that would be able to conduct shallow penetration operations across the border into Pakistan in response to a terrorist attack, to go after the camps where these terrorists are housed and trained, and then, if need be, withdraw, but in any case not penetrate so far that it challenges any of Pakistan's central red lines for nuclear use. It's a very dicey proposition. A lot of people in India do not see that as an operation that the Indian Army is particularly capable of conducting. In any case, they haven't developed the doctrine to the extent that they've operationalized it, in the sense that they have full capabilities to do it. You will hear voices from India saying that we ought to pursue this policy now in response to Mumbai, but by and large, the Indian government tends to be more conservative and more cautious, and in my judgment, they will continue to respond to this in diplomatic terms rather than trying to conduct conflict. That said, India continues to be frustrated by its own passivity, as many will call it, in response to these terrorist attacks. And something that has higher symbolic value, this one certainly did in Mumbai, but if, for example, LET, Lashkar-e-Taiba, or Jaish Mohammed were responsible, say, for the assassination of the Indian Prime Minister or the Indian President, that might then prompt India to induct its cold start doctrine and engage in war of limited duration against Pakistan. So I'll stop at that point. Thank you very much, Mark.
Thank you, and thank you so much for taking that perspective and presenting the Pakistan perspective so clearly and giving us a context as well there. I'm going to turn now to the perspective that we should be sharing, which is the U.S. perspective, or at least understanding in a much clearer fashion. Daniel Snyder is the Associate Director for Research at Stanford University's Shorenstein APARC, and he currently directs a 3-year comparative study of the formation of historical memory in East Asia. His own research is focused on current U.S. foreign and national security policy in Asia. And I should add that he and I were colleagues in Moscow years ago, which I just found out during the days of the Soviet Union becoming the former Soviet Union. So, presenting the U.S. perspective, Daniel Snyder.
Thank you, Marcos, and it's always difficult to be the third one on a 3-man panel, but I'm going to try and focus on the U.S. policy goals in this situation. Let me start out, though, with a small anecdote. Immediately after the attacks in Mumbai, I sent an email to an old friend of mine, an Indian friend, a former journalist and very senior Indian policymaker, expressing my condolences for what had happened. He was actually in Mumbai at the time. And I referred to, you know, an act of madness. And rather than a sort of, you know, some appreciation for my gesture, I got back an angry reply. This is from an old friend, so he was felt free to be angry. And the source of his anger was that the perception that this was seen as sort of an act of just terrorist madness, rather than a directed consequence of the policies of Pakistan, that is a Pakistani directed attack on India. And particularly he was angry at the United States for what he saw as American failure to respond to that reality in the Indian view, that is that they had been attacked by Pakistan and that the United States had not taken on Pakistan in a tough-minded way. And I think that kind of defines the complexity of U.S. policymaking in South Asia. We have very important but often conflicting goals. One of our goals, which Neil has already mentioned, is to prevent conflict between India and Pakistan. We're all worried about the possibility of some situation escalating out of control when you have two nuclear-armed states. And that is, they've been on the brink of that in the past, and the U.S. intervened in the past to try and cool that off. The second is priority in the region is to reverse the declining security situation in Afghanistan. And this is the central preoccupation these days of the new administration in Washington, the Obama administration. The third is to pursue al-Qaeda and its allies. The fourth is to reinforce civilian rule in Pakistan, while at the same time maintaining and even gaining greater cooperation of the Pakistani military. That's a very delicate challenge. And lastly, we have the goal of deepening our partnership with India, a partnership that in some ways has at least seemed to be headed in the vector towards alliance and beyond partnership towards alliance. But the attack in Mumbai really creates a tremendous amount of tension between these goals because obviously when India and Pakistan have very differing narratives about what happened there, it's very hard for the United States to formulate a policy, a response to these events, which is going to satisfy both of those parties. So the goal of securing Pakistani cooperation, particularly in regards to dealing with the rise of the Taliban or the resurgence of the Taliban in Afghanistan, really comes into conflict with a goal of deepening our partnership with India and responding to Indian concerns. And I'd like just to say a little bit about the attacks, because I don't feel this, and this is my view. You know, the Indian government issued a fairly thick dossier on the attacks early in January. And it's it makes for pretty interesting reading. And this is the dossier which they're waiting for the Pakistanis to respond to formally. But I think that it contains a considerable amount of evidence. One of the 10 terrorists who was involved in this attack was captured alive. In addition, they, in a mistake that sometimes happens even in well-organized terrorist operations, they left a satellite phone on board the ship the Indian fishing vessel that they had captured, and they left some other considerable evidence. And there were intercepts. They were talking on their cell phones while they were in these hotels and other facilities for 3 days carrying out these these attacks. They were carrying out cell phone conversations with their the people that were directing them in Pakistan, and these were intercepted. And I believe this is not a secret, but the United States has really cooperated pretty extensively with Indian intelligence authorities after the attacks. The FBI has been very active. They've done a lot of work, in not only in the forensic side, but in other sides in collecting intelligence. And I think the dossier makes a pretty powerful case that these were Pakistanis, all of them. This attack originated in Pakistan. It was directed out of Pakistan, and it was carried out by an organization which has already been referred to that is very well known, Lashkar-e-Taiba. And this organization was formed, it's a military wing of an organization was formed in the late 1980s. It has a long history. It has a long history of close association with the Pakistani military, and particularly with the Pakistani military's intelligence arm. It's been active not only in Kashmir, but also it was active in support of the Taliban in the earlier phase when the Taliban took power in Afghanistan in the 1990s. The RAND Corporation, in a little report that they did looking at this attack in Mumbai, said this. They concluded, they said, these groups are not strictly non-state actors, but rather extensions of the state intelligence apparatus, albeit with some degree of plausible deniability. After becoming an overt nuclear power, Pakistan has become emboldened to prosecute conflict at the lower end of the spectrum, confident that nuclear weapons minimize the likelihood of an Indian military reaction. And generally, from what I've seen from American intelligence officials, they share the Indian assessment that this attack was directed out of Pakistan. What is not clear is who in Pakistan wanted this to happen, whether there were elements of the Pakistani military, the intelligence services, who were pushing for this to happen without the knowledge of the civilian government, certainly, and maybe perhaps without the knowledge of the general staff of General Kiani and others. So, you know, where exactly the responsibility lies in Pakistan is certainly not clear, but that this attack originates in Pakistan, I think the evidence for this is pretty powerful. So that poses some serious difficulties. I think that the attempt to depict this as a product of a domestic Indian conflict is a hard case to make. Certainly there are sympathizers within India, and certainly to some degree the Kashmir conflict is a, not only feeds this, but it creates the locus by which these groups can make their cause known and gain support for their cause. But I think that it's hard to argue that this is an internally generated event. And therefore for the Indians, this is a case of aggression. And how do you respond to it? I think the Indian response has been very restrained, but that's only up to the point that they are waiting for the Pakistani government to act. And I think the Pakistani government has acted in a limited way. They arrested, put under house arrest, and arrested and detained other members of this organization, including its leader. But in the past, they've banned this organization. They banned it in 2002 after the 9/11 attacks. It reemerged under a different name. So there's not a lot of confidence that this is actually an attempt to seriously crack down on this organization and really to try and eliminate it. And there's a good reason for the Pakistani army and the Pakistani leadership to want to do this, because although they've encouraged these organizations and used them in the past, as Neil has outlined, they're in fact undermining their own authority increasingly. And increasingly the Pakistani government is fighting a battle against the Taliban and Islamic extremists within its own borders. And so there's a reason to believe that they will be receptive to pressure to act in this way. So I think for the Indian government, for the U.S. government, the question is, how do we balance our concerns, our need for Pakistani cooperation in dealing with the problem in Afghanistan and more broadly with the problems of stability in Pakistan, with the, I think, legitimate concerns that the Indians express and which we ought to share, that these organizations, you're never going to get stability in Pakistan, you're never going to deal with the ultimate security problems unless the Pakistani government's really willing to go after these organizations in a fairly ruthless way. And that's where we sit right at this moment. The Obama government administration has already said this is a priority for them, this region. They've appointed a special envoy Mr. Holbrook, who's a very well-known diplomat who was involved in the in finding the solution to the Bosnia conflict. He's about to head off, I think, any hour now on his first trip to the region. He's a special envoy for Pakistan and Afghanistan. There was some talk earlier on that his responsibility would include all of South Asia, including India. The Indians didn't like that idea, in part because they were worried that the United States would basically put pressure on them to make Kashmir a subject of international discussion, that we would, in order to deal with Pakistani concerns and try and gain Pakistani cooperation, that we would put pressure on India to be willing to make Kashmir a subject of international negotiation, which they've had a consistent policy of opposing. The Obama administration backed off from some initial feelers on that, but I think that issue is still going to be out there. It's going to resurface. So just to conclude, I think the problem is that we're balancing, as I said, different priorities, all of them in some sense crucial goals and concerns of American policy, but not all ones which can be melded together seamlessly, in which there's tension between them. And it'll be, I think, one of the most serious challenges facing the new administration is going to be dealing with Pakistan and with Afghanistan and with all the security problems that originate out of this nexus. You stop there.
Well, thank you very much, Daniel. It sounds like a volatile cocktail, and I have heard from all of you and have not heard anything that gives me great comfort in terms of the status quo, the weakness of the government, for instance, in India, and the upcoming elections, and the turmoil that is likely to occur as they try to build domestic support for nationalist policies oftentimes, confronting an intransigent Pakistan that will practice denial of this dossier, perhaps, and, of course, is also facing a leadership challenge in the context of a United States government which is brand new, untested, and has a very different perspective on what is important and how this regional issue must be dealt with. This is a very difficult situation. And if I can ask Rafiq, I mean, are we looking at a period when, for instance, the Indians, I think, have enjoyed the Bush administration in many ways, and what the Bush administration has brought to the bilateral relationship? There must be great fear in terms of how this focus is now shifting, first because the administration is changing, and secondly because of some of the things that Dan mentioned, and that was mentioned by Neil as well, that we have Kashmir brought up. We're talking about the solution to Afghanistan within a regional context. Those are a lot of questions, but let's deal first with the change from the Bush administration to the Obama administration.
Sure. There was considerable worry in India when the Obama administration, which had yet to assume office, announced that they would be appointing an envoy for South Asia. That then raised the red flag within India, as Dan pointed out, that Kashmir would be part of that brief, and as a result of being part of his brief or her brief, would then raise issues in India which would be unacceptable. As Dan pointed out, India has consistently refused to raise the Kashmir issue except bilaterally with Pakistan. Pakistan equally has refused to recognize India's legitimacy over all of Kashmir or the parts that it controls, and has at the same time, responded to mistakes the Indians made, for example, the elections in 1987 that Neil mentioned, where the elections were rigged in Kashmir. By looking for these openings, they have succeeded in supporting, through terrorism or militancy, the problems in Kashmir. So that was a concern of the Indians. Now, in fact, it doesn't seem so bad. So from the Indian point of view, it appears that Mr. Holbrook's brief will not extend to Kashmir. The question is, having satisfied themselves on that score, is that a good thing or not? Will it help solve the problem of terrorism into India from Pakistan if the U.S. Special Envoy just focuses on Pakistan-Afghanistan relations and the issues that come up there? Or will it hurt? Does India benefit by being part of that discussion? Should they have, in fact, welcomed a Holbrook who would look at all of South Asia, but maybe asked him to focus more on this sort of issue of global terrorism, as the Indians call it, My sense is the Indians missed an opportunity. They should have firmly insisted that they would not discuss Kashmir, but that Holbrooke was very welcome to discuss other issues of terrorism. It's not that he is currently barred from doing so, but by restricting his brief due to Indian pressure to just Afghanistan and Pakistan, I think the Indians missed an opportunity, because the reality is Pakistan will not stop or is not in any position to stop this sort of activity. And what we will see over the next year, perhaps with some lull for the elections, because there's some logic for terrorism to stop now for a few months, after May it will start again. And nothing that Holbrooke does or that this Obama administration does with regard to Pakistan and Afghanistan is going to change that a bit. Because in Pakistan's eyes, Kashmir is as significant a problem as Afghanistan.
Neil, do you have any thoughts here in terms of, first of all, the Bush relationship and how that changeover? I asked because when we looked at your dates, you were active with the administration.
Yes, I was at the State Department in the first administration for a couple of years, and then at the National Security Council working on the President's staff on India-Pakistan issues. And I think the Bush administration got it right with respect to India. That is that India is a natural ally to the United States, and that the Bush administration was prepared to grasp the thistle of nonproliferation and overcome the objections in policy, the obstructions in law and policy that prevented us from having a healthier relationship with India. This is by and large supported by the Obama administration. I think they intend to carry that forward, and I certainly hope they do. I think they appreciate the progress that was made in U.S.-India relations. All of that said, the Pakistan Afghanistan issue is so difficult to deal with, so tortuous, that you really do want to try and get help, and you want to get India's help in doing that. But at the same time, as you're working with Pakistan and trying to be constructive with Pakistan, they will, quite understandably, and I've just touched on some of their history, want to say, well, this problem that you're looking at in between Pakistan and Afghanistan, and within Afghanistan, will be made better if we also try and solve the problem of Kashmir. So the U.S. is in a delicate position, as it always has been, between these two states. And I think we've made the right move with respect to re-stabilizing the relationship with India. But now we need to work with India as best we can to engage the Pakistan-Afghanistan problem.
And so, Dan, we're now, as you mentioned earlier, I think tonight, Secretary of State, almost called her Senator Clinton, Secretary of State Clinton is having dinner with Dick Holbrooke, who's heading off to the region. What does that trip look like? Where does he land? What does he do? Who does he talk to? And what does he hope to accomplish? And I guess even more importantly, what sort of time frame is he looking to do this within? Because this being such a hurried trip, it's at the beginning of an administration. They are signaling how important that this region is with sending such a high-level and highly visible envoy to the region. I think expectations will also be that something might occur quickly rather than over a period of time.
Well, I think you're right. It's first of all meant to send a signal. And I noticed that they did the same thing, of course, in dispatching their other special envoy, former Senator Mitchell, to the Middle East. So the signal is, you know, we're engaged, we intend to be engaged, this is a high priority issue for us. Now, at the same time, there has been an ongoing review of Afghanistan and Pakistan being carried out under the auspices of the Central Command under General Petraeus's direction, and to review broad strategy towards the region. And I think there's this consensus that we need to take what's called a regional approach, which means that problems of Afghanistan can't be solved just within Afghanistan. They principally actually are going to be solved within Pakistan, because that's the sanctuary for those that are destabilizing the situation in Afghanistan. But it may also involve cooperation with Iran, which is an interesting aspect of this, because Iran has significant influence in Afghanistan and to some degree has been an opponent of the Taliban, as well as obviously bringing in India. And I think I don't know whether Ambassador Holbrooke's agenda for this trip is anything more than simply to make the personal connections that he needs to make with both the government in Islamabad and in Kabul to begin that process. But I do think that there is going to be some decisions made at a fairly significant level fairly soon in this administration about things like force levels in Afghanistan, how we, as I said, what's our broad strategic approach. And I think that's going to happen within weeks, because, as I said, the process is already ongoing. I don't see a quick, there is no quick solution to these problems, and I think everyone who's looked for quick solutions over the years has ended up extremely frustrated. The real, I think, one of the crucial questions is, what do we do about the civilian government in Pakistan? We want to support the government that came to power democratically. General Musharraf, who ruled for a long time, is out. We have a civilian president, civilian prime minister, but their authority is very weak. And how do we strengthen their authority while also maintaining a cooperative relationship with the military? I would think that's going to be one of the big things on Ambassador Holbrooke's agenda.
Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, we were talking about India-U.S. relationships at first, but the question of U.S.-Pakistan relationships is one that also has been brought up, particularly during the election campaign when candidate Obama had discussed the potential of taking out terrorists in sovereign territory within Pakistan under very specific circumstances, but nonetheless really questioning the sovereign ability of Pakistan to control its what are referred to oftentimes as outlaw areas. And now with the buildup, as Dan suggests, which is forthcoming in Afghanistan right next door, perhaps a great buildup when we get to NATO's 60th anniversary in April with a greater commitment of Western forces. How does Pakistan look at this increased presence of the United States in that region and the stated willingness to act within its sovereign territory?
Was that directed at me?
That was directed at you, Neil.
Let me try and respond. Pakistan is a sovereign nation that doesn't have complete control of all parts of its country. This is not unusual. There are many states that have that problem. There are parts of the inner city in America where people are cautious before they proceed. In any case, Pakistan's not unusual in that because this area has always been not lawless, but run by the law of Pashtunwala, the law of the people who live there. So it is not lawless, but it is a law that is not dictated by the central government in Islamabad. So at the same time that Pakistan recognizes this and that they cannot control all elements in the federally administered tribal areas, at the same time they are a sovereign state with a seat of the United Nations and a functioning government, and they're doing their darndest to control it and not sacrifice their own national security. So we have to respect that, but at the same time recognize that we are engaged in a war not of our own choosing, a war begun by Al-Qaeda against us on September 11, 2001, and therefore we are trying to prosecute that war to a successful conclusion. Now, there's a problem of alliance management with all of this as well, because to some extent, perhaps fortunately or unfortunately, after September 11, NATO invoked the clause that said an attack on any one of the members of NATO is an attack against all. So now what we're conducting is a combined operations war against Al-Qaeda, against the Taliban, along this border area, and it is having a very debilitating effect on NATO, because some NATO members do not want their soldiers to be involved in combat. The Canadians have been taking a very strong role in terms of combat in Kandahar. The U.S. has, from the perspective of some in NATO, not spent enough effort on Afghanistan because of the distraction of Iraq. So there's a lot coming together here, and all I can say is with Mr. Holbrooke's attention on it and his full-bore attention, I'm trying to be optimistic, but it is an extremely complicated war and extremely complicated political nexus.
But Neil, you were also, and this is coming from your comments earlier, you've also pointed out that while the government of Pakistan is trying to take control of these regions and really assert itself, on the other hand, it's also been very supportive of some of those militant groups that are in those regions, and so they've been feeding, in many ways, the materiel at times enough, and I understand at times training of those very forces that you also are suggesting that the government is trying to control. And you said both those things in your opening comments, But it's easy for someone on the outside, whether it be the United States or a NATO force, to say, look, you know, you're not really doing very much at all. You're, in fact, feeding those forces that are attacking us.
The Pakistanis bristle when that is said. They have lost a large number of forces fighting along the border. Pakistan's in this position of wanting to work with the United States toward U.S. objectives, but not sacrifice its own security in the sense that the outcome in Afghanistan ultimately helps India. The central concern for Pakistan is and always has been India. They see India as the fundamental threat. And they have not made a sort of a sea change in interpreting the strongest threat to their own integrity and to their ability to govern as being coming from either the Taliban or internal terrorist forces. They still see that as something manageable, and over the long run, what they really have to be concerned about is that India will have an opportunity to make mischief and undercut Pakistan as a state. They look to the 1971 war, where India took advantage of Pakistan's, as the Pakistanis see it. Now, I agree with a lot of what Dan said. I don't necessarily agree with what the Pakistanis said, but I think you wanted to get as much as possible everybody's perspective, and so that's what I'm trying to present. But from their view, India took advantage of Pakistan's internal breakdown, and they'll do it again. And so they can't let them into Afghanistan, and if that means trying to reconstruct the Taliban in some form, they will want to do that. But what they don't want at the end of the day in Afghanistan is an open field for India to basically control the political outcome. And that means that they are both with us, and yet they're not necessarily against us, but they're with us for now. But at the back end, when they see the U.S. taking off and returning to our own shores, at that point they're going to be left to confront with the problem, as they did in 1990, and they don't want that to be an environment where India has total control of Afghanistan.
Did you have something to add, Dan?
Well, I think, you know, this is a very important point, because and it's one that Americans have difficulty understanding. We've tended to deal with Pakistan in the context of the post 9/11 world, in which the central issue for us is dealing with the people who attacked us, Al-Qaeda and their allies. And so that's the framing of the issue for us, but that has never been the framing of the issue for Pakistan. And the fact that there's a disjointed set of priorities here is really at the core of some of our problems. And I think that that's why it's a little dangerous, if I can disagree with my colleague from Stanford, it's a little dangerous to open up the Kashmir box, because it tends to lend credibility to those in Pakistan who want to frame this issue as an India-Pakistan question. And really, it isn't an India-Pakistan question at its essence, I think. For us, the United States, I mean, it is more an Afghanistan-Pakistan question, if you will, in which India certainly has a significant role. So there's a little danger, significant danger, in going down that road for the sake of perhaps trying to mollify Pakistani concerns about India.
Rafiq.
I think this is where Richard Holbrook can play a role in terms of actually working with the Pakistani government and the Afghan government, with the assurance that what America will do will set in place over the long term, hopefully, or rather not too long, a government in Afghanistan that manages its own affairs in a self-reliant way and that looks for friendship with Pakistan. As Neil very correctly pointed out, that Pakistan's central worry is India. It drives from the wars they've had and the loss of Bangladesh, and they see India's hand in anything that threatens their security, including Afghanistan. And I think here is an opportunity for Holbrooke to do something that will help Pakistan feel more comfortable about India.
You know, it's we have a lot of questions from the audience, and one of them actually tries to bring in some hope into this equation, because we've talked about the confrontational posture of these countries, and of course the militancy that exists in all of them, and to the point where there is in fact hot war at times, if limited. But what opportunities exist, and in this question particularly, through economic relations between the nations? Is there enough activity and an exchange to mollify some of this anger and distrust? Yes, Rafiq Dosani.
Well, interestingly, this is a subject that Dan and I have been studying for the last year or so. Even though there is no formal free trade arrangement or treaty of trade between Pakistan and India, and the regional association, the SARC as it's called, the South Asian Association for Regional Cooperation, is quite a failure. Despite that, trade between India and Pakistan is soaring. It has, I think, gone up 7 times in the last 7 years from a low base, but it's now about $4 billion a year, which is not insignificant from the viewpoint of the Pakistani economy. If you talk to business people in Pakistan, as I found out when I was there in May last year giving a talk to their Chamber of Commerce, and found that the thing that they really want is close connections with India. They do not see their economic future by looking at Afghanistan, Iran, and that side of the world. They see it by looking, by turning their heads towards towards India. This, of course, reflects the general paradox of South Asia, that there are certain commonalities in their view. I mean, if you ask an Indian businessman, he'd say the same thing. I mean, I've spoken, for example, with the largest telecom operator in India, Bharti Telecom's CEO. He said, we would love to do business with Pakistan, but we aren't allowed to because of the trade barriers. So I think, however hard it is, and here I really believe India has a central role in making trade-based regional integration possible, and that India has not stepped up to the plate in fulfilling this role. I think that can play a significant role in ameliorating the distrust of India. After all, what is Pakistan worried about? I mean, Indians keep saying, Bangladesh is over, Bangladeshis themselves wanted it, etc., etc. You treated them very badly. Since then, we haven't really taken away any of your territory, notwithstanding the little bit on Kargil in 72. But, the point is, don't be worried. And I think trade would help that process.
Anyone else on the economic question? We have another question here, which is in some ways related, because it talks about resources. And the questioner suggests that water is perhaps one of the bigger issues regarding Kashmir and its allocation. It's something not unfamiliar to us here in California, being that water wars are so significant. So maybe we can all relate to that question. Is there something there that where there can be an accommodation of resources to help find political solutions?
So, there is the long-standing 1956 Indus Waters Treaty, which, despite the wars that the two countries have fought, still exists to this date. And it is always something that Pakistan is worried about, but India has kept its share of the bargain faithfully. Likewise, there are issues in Kashmir as well, because there are rivers that originate in Kashmir, in Indian-controlled part of Kashmir, which go into Pakistan, and the issue of the Baglihar Dam keeps coming up. But this is something where both sides seem to have worked it out in some ways, saying we won't disturb the status quo for the time being. And I think India has shown good faith in this. And if you look at its relationship with other neighbors, for example, the Bangladesh issue of the Farakka Barrage, which is another dam on the Indian side of the Ganges River, India has kept good faith with Bangladesh in that. So, yes, I think there are opportunities to use water sharing, which is so increasingly a critical issue as both countries develop, as a means to improve cooperation.
Those of us who've been watching the last few weeks develop at the State Department have heard Secretary of State Clinton use the phrase smart power, and I'm trying to think of how do we apply it to this particular region, but one of the things that strikes me is that in the United States as well as in Great Britain, there are an awful lot of expatriate populations that also both provide resources and intellectual capital back to that region. Is there any role for those expatriate populations to play in the foreign policy that's shaped by the Western powers in trying to come up with a regional solution?
Well, I think in Silicon Valley we have actually an interesting situation, because we have entrepreneurs of Indian origin and of Pakistani origin who actually have worked together in entrepreneurs associations to promote the kind of cooperation which Rafiq was talking about between India and Pakistan. So delegations from the what's called the Indus Entrepreneurs Association have gone to Pakistan. They're mainly Indians, but they've gone to Pakistan, and they've really responded to the desire in Pakistan to sort of emulate what's happened in India to move up the technological ladder. So I think actually the entrepreneurial community here actually can play a very important role in sort of encouraging these nascent moves towards economic cooperation.
And is there a large, you know, oftentimes in countries that are overseas, there's an awful lot of invisible transfer of funds, the movement of capital from, say, the United States or other countries into those regions. Is that something that's significant in those countries? Do you know? No?
I could add yes. to that, yes. Well, India is the largest recipient of overseas flows from non-residents to India. It's about $40 billion a year, which is large. The next largest is Pakistan, is China at about $25 billion. My sense is this does not play a role in the relations between the two countries. I did want to point out, Dan mentioned the Indus Entrepreneurs. Actually, the very first trip that was taken by this group called TAI, the Indus Entrepreneurs, was in the year 2000. Actually, it was a joint Stanford APAC TAI trip, and I was on that trip. And so a bunch of us, about 15 of us, 13 of whom I think were of Indian origin, and two Pakistani entrepreneurs, I went to Pakistan, and we were received by the Prime Minister very well. I mean, he said his greatest desire, he was an ex-city banker, Shaukat Aziz, and his greatest desire was to see a better relation. So, I mean, I think that story, that narrative that the diaspora can play a positive role is true. It also plays a negative role in the sense, you know, lately after the terrorist attacks, the Indian diaspora has been very active in urging the U.S. government to take a much more strident stance, something that has not been welcomed by the Pakistani diaspora here. The Indo-U.S., the nuclear fuel agreement which took place last year was something, again, where they were on opposite sides of this agreement. So it varies, you know. I don't think there's a consistently positive role that business people can play.
On the other hand, then, you know, there was a talk, of course, back in the days of the attacks on the Golden Temple, that there was a great deal of support by the expatriate communities, and perhaps even California and some of the residents here had something to do with that. Is there a feeding on the Pakistan side of some of the more militant groups from those who were outside of the country?
I don't think there's a large base of support for the militant groups, terrorist groups within Pakistan from outside. There's certainly a nexus between Afghanistan and Pakistan, but this is fairly much homegrown. It's not the kind of thing that you saw with the Khalistan movement in the 1980s, which was heavily supported by non-resident Sikhs who saw the need from afar for an independent state to represent the interests of the Sikhs. We saw a lot of support for that, for example, coming from the Sikh community in Vancouver, Canada, as well as elsewhere. But I have not seen that particularly, but I prepare to defer to Rafiq or Dan on that.
So, you know, one of the main questions that always arises when we talk about this region, even though there's something quite active with the hot wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, and you all touched on it, is the nuclear reality of the region. And of course, in one particular case, we've even seen the proliferation of nuclear technologies from the region outside, and we don't quite know the extent of it to this point. But how does this nuclear equation play into this? Is it, for instance, when the question of India is brought up, or rather Pakistan always suggests that India is looked at. But is this nuclear equation one that has brought equality to their relationships? Has it equalized their military capabilities?
I would say it's not equalized their military capabilities. In conventional terms, India continues to have a preponderance of power. That said, that preponderance of power isn't something that you can use to your advantage if you fear that the consequence of its use is the recourse to nuclear weapons on the part of your enemy. So Pakistan has a kind of veto capability over India's use of some of that conventional superiority, which is precisely why they developed the nuclear capability in the first place. Their experience in 1971 was a hard lesson, where because of India's conventional superiority, they were effectively able to roll over Pakistani troops and capture 70 or 90,000 of them in a fairly short period of time. Pakistan feared that this would happen again unless Pakistan developed nuclear weapons, which is why they proceeded to do so. So now you wouldn't really say that they're equal in any kind of conventional measure, but it does provide Pakistan an ability to thwart India's use of some of that superiority.
But, and as you suggested earlier, not able to entirely rule out the possibility that there would be direct conflict and perhaps even an escalating conflict.
We've seen as much conflict since the development of nuclear weapons, or the overt announcement, if you will, of their nuclear capability in 98 as before. There was a serious war in 1999. There was a near war in 2001 and 2002. We came very close. We're right now looking at the real possibility of war. I don't think it would happen, as I said before. I think cooler heads will prevail. India has a range of actions it can take if Pakistan's response to its brief is deemed inadequate, well short of open conflict. But nuclear weapons have not prevented conflict from occurring. One of the arguments about the value, if you will, of nuclear weapons is that they create a situation where each side is, in a sense, in a bargaining relationship with the other side. And they want the other side to quit before they are forced to quit. And neither side wants to end up having the worst case happen, which is the actual use of nuclear weapons. So we end up in this relationship where they're each trying to further their strategic objectives and push the other side and hope that the other side backs down well before nuclear weapons come into play. But conflict is very much part of the landscape in South Asia. It's likely to continue to be part of the landscape in South Asia, both at the unconventional level in the sense of terrorist attacks and potentially at the level of conventional army-on-army conflict across the border.
Daniel Snyder.
You know, I'm a little bit concerned about what's going to happen with the Pakistani response to the Indian dossier, which is going to come, they say, this week, and it'll probably coincide with Ambassador Holbrooke's arrival in Pakistan, which makes it a very interesting moment, because if the Pakistanis do not seriously respond, and in my mind, and I think clearly in the Indian mind, seriously responds means they have to acknowledge that these attacks operated out of Pakistan. Whether, as I said, whether the question of responsibility, where it extends to, that's a different question. But if they don't do that, then there's going to be tremendous pressure in India to respond in some way. There's a lot of talk about, you know, attacking a camp somewhere or, you know, some sort of minimalist military response, which I find a little bit dangerous talk because, first of all, there's no real effective military target to hit of that nature. But secondly, you know, there's no way you can ensure that any kind of response like that remains at that level. You've opened up an escalatory situation. And therefore, I think one of the crucial things is that the United States, I think, has to put very direct pressure on the Pakistani government and on the Pakistani military, because sometimes these channels need to be not so much from Ambassador Holbrooke to the President of Pakistan, but also from General Petraeus or Admiral Mullen to their Pakistani army counterparts, that they need to respond in a significant way. And I think the Indian government needs to see the United States is doing that kind of is putting that kind of pressure on Pakistan. It has to be visible enough to allow them to be able to, I think, dampen down those within India who would like to act in a more escalatory fashion.
Rafiq Dasani?
Yeah, the problem that Dan's proposal raises, that the Pakistani government must respond in some visible, substantive way, is that it assumes too much, I think, about the capabilities of the Pakistani government. As a weak civilian government, I think there are fairly good odds on there being another military coup fairly soon in Pakistan. And, Zardari is very concerned as president of the country that he has to balance this. If there's anyone who has capabilities to, any group that has the capability to do something substantive about the terrorists on Pakistani soil, it's the military, not the civilian government, and the two don't get along. Even if you ask about the nuclear asset, so to speak, that Pakistan has, it's not clear. I mean, the odds are it's not controlled by the civilian government. It's controlled by the military. And so expecting Holbrooke to tell Zardari, you know, you really must do something substantive is probably asking too much, in my opinion.
Do you expect that if there isn't this response from Pakistan, that India will feel compelled to make some sort of overt action or attack?
I agree with Dan that the pressure will start building up again. We saw this in early December, right after the attacks, where the media was constantly pressuring the government, saying, do something now. And then when nothing was done and when Pakistan ultimately promised to respond, things cooled down. As I said, the real issue for me is that there's an election coming up in India shortly by May, and that raises two possibilities. One is that the Indian government will try and make some sort of response for fear of losing face among the electorate. I see that as a lesser likelihood than the Indian government saying, look, you know, we'll manage this in a calm, peaceful, mature way at the right time and will not do anything.
And Neil Jock, do you have a perspective on this? Do they attack if there's not an answer, if not an acceptance of responsibility?
I think not. I think India has other avenues they can pursue with respect to trade, with respect to restricting dialogue, with respect to diplomatic measures, recalling ambassadors, and so on, and that those have symbolic value and symbolic importance so that India can say to its people that we are not ignoring this, we are taking steps, we are not treating this as a normal relationship because of Pakistan's failure to refusal to accept responsibility. But I think conflict would be difficult and unproductive, and I think India's judgment would be is that that's what the terrorists would like to see happen. That would benefit the terrorists. It would not benefit either India or Pakistan. So I'd be quite surprised if India were to take military action.
And of course, those who are foes of either government understand the volatility of the situation as well and might see this as an opportune time to launch yet another attack or some symbolic effort to try and further destabilize the situation on the ground. You sometimes deal in likelihoods, all of you, in terms of how these things occur in these areas. Where would these attacks possibly come from? Would they be something like the Lashkar-Taibi group, or are there domestic groups that would also engage in something like this, say, in India? And I think we all would understand that the time is fairly ripe for them to do so.
If one was to make a prediction, I would say that after the elections in May, as I was saying, after that there will be more attacks. Whether it's by Lashkar-e-Tayyaba or some other group in Pakistan, these things are just chameleons, you know. They have infinite mutations. You don't know who it really is. These are groups in some indirect way linked with Kashmir, linked with Afghanistan, and tightly linked perhaps more to the military, and this will happen.
And in terms of military type of action within Pakistan, are there groups of colonels or generals that are assembling right now in that country and discussing the legitimacy of the civilian government as the Prime Minister is in Davos?
I think the Pakistan military, to a large extent, feels that its fingers were burned by the period of Musharraf's rule. The military's role, and the reason people join the military in Pakistan, is to defend the nation, not to govern the country. And they would very much like to see civilian leadership and civilian responsibility and responsiveness to Pakistan's needs on the part of the civilian politicians and the civil sector. So I think they're in a position now where they see that their return to power was only marginally successful, that it ended badly, better than prior military invasions, the prior military coups, but nonetheless not as productive as they would like. And I think they'll be quite cautious about intervening again in the near future. I think it would take a fundamental breakdown nationwide in order for the Pakistani military to decide it needs to take over authority in Islamabad. Right now, it's clearly working very hard and is very strained to meet the demands of the created by the terrorist attacks that are spreading in Pakistan, the area of the Swat Valley, which previously was well under the control of the central authority, is now no longer so, and it's a very big challenge for the Pakistan military to address that. So I do not see them wanting to add to their burden by taking on the reins of government responsibility at this time.
Any final comments in terms of give us something that we can be optimistic about? We're all wishing Ambassador Holbrooke a successful and positive trip. We hope that they all like him, or at least are willing to talk to him, and are able to come up with some suggestions for how they can improve regional security. But is there anything that we can look forward to during this administration that maybe hasn't occurred in the last 8 years?
Well, in my mind, the important thing is that the Obama administration understands that this is the central problem that it has to deal with. I think the criticism of the Bush administration's taking its eye off the ball, if you will, was a correct one. And I think it's welcome that the administration is coming in saying, okay, this is the place where we have to really focus our attention. I mean, they're not going to be quick solutions, but I think the important thing is that this is going to get their attention in a big way, and that the instruments of power that they want to use in this situation are not just military instruments, but also those of development aid, of diplomacy, of, as I said, regional approaches to solving the problem. And that's not just a view of the new administration. I think that's also a view that's very strongly held these days in the Pentagon as well, and that's important. So I think there's going to be a consensus about how to approach this, and hopefully it will yield some success.
I think Secretary Clinton will employ smart power in the sense of focusing on the three Ds, defense, development, and diplomacy, and that an adroit combination of these elements will prove to be salutary, that India and Pakistan will get better in the next several years and that they will weather this. They've had a way of muddling through in the past, and I think they'll do it again. I hope that's not just a Pollyanna-ish optimism. But I would also say that there's a kind of a three cups of tea optimism as well, and I'm sure many people in this room have read Three Cups of Tea. And as you read that, I don't think it provides diplomatic guidance, but I think it provides human guidance. And that on the ground, I think there are a lot of people of good heart and good intent, and that we need to figure out how to connect with those people on the ground who really are weary of the conflict and would like to live productive lives for themselves and their children. So that's a note of optimism that I took from reading that book, and I'd recommend it to those of you who haven't read it.
You know, for the last decade, India has taken off and the other countries of South Asia have been held behind. And it's almost as if South Asia did not exist, there'd be no need to invent it. India has looked globally, has almost denied that it is part of South Asia except when there's been trouble in its backyard. So for me, the hope is that this realization will change, one. And the basis for that hope is that democracy as a value actually permeates all of South Asia. It's really remarkable that no matter whether Pakistan has been under a dictatorship or a democracy, I mean, dictatorship being military rule, the default preference, which always comes back, is democracy. Every military coup is promptly followed by the coup leader saying he intends to hold elections in the near future. And this permeates all of South Asia, whether it be Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, India, or Pakistan. I think that fundamental value, and with it what it implies in terms of the willingness of people to work together, and also the fact that today, for the first time in many years, all of South Asia, at least these four main countries, are democracies. I think that's the good news.
I think it's a wonderful note to end our evening on. I hope you're feeling a bit more optimistic than when you arrived, and let's wish our envoy the best of luck. Thank you for joining us.
Good to see you. Nice to share the podium.
I just have to stir it up a little. Yeah.